Hey everybody, my name is Lee Olson, and I'm so glad you're here because today we are doing the blood, sweat, and blessings portion of the show, where we bring in somebody that's truly made a dent in this world, somebody that we can all take something from to find out exactly how and why they did what they did. We're going to pull back the curtain and we're going to find out exactly what blood and what sweat it took to get to the blessings that they have today. So if this show has made a difference in your life, give us a 5-star review, share it, of course, but leave us a comment. Tell us what you'd like to see or tell us how it has helped you in your story. I'm glad you're here and enjoy.
All right, welcome everybody. I've got one of my best friends on here. This is Brad Jackman, Dr. Brad Jackman. I like to call him Dr. Google. Like, if there's a problem, he can solve it. So, Brad, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So, I don't want to make a fool of myself. Would you tell us the alphabet soup that's behind your name?
Well, yeah, I'm a doctor of veterinary medicine, DVM. So I graduated from Kansas State University, born and bred and raised in Kansas, and then did an internship and surgical residency after that at the University of Georgia. So I also got my master's there, and so I got an MS behind my name for the master's in physiology and pharmacology. And then the DACVS stands for a Diplomat of America College of Veterinary Surgeons. So it just means I'm a board certified surgeon. So
Nice.
yeah, just trying to gain more knowledge.
That's awesome. Well, you've definitely excelled and achieved that. So that's
Yeah,
awesome.
thanks. Yeah.
So before we get into your story, we've got some really exciting stuff coming, don't we?
Yeah.
So we're gonna start a mini series, and what we're gonna do is we're just gonna have 20 or 30 minute episodes talking about just common practice problems that we see in all horses, but specifically performance horses.
Yeah, I mean, it's just I like to help the horse. I mean, my whole career has been just about helping the horse. So if we can help another horse, all be it. Let's go for it.
Yeah, that's mine too. So we're gonna have the vet and the farrier relationship here, and we also both do a lot of competing. So hopefully we can find a way to help you and your horse with some common problems that we've seen.
Yeah.
So, all right. So back to you. So I always call Brad Super Vet, and I want everybody on here to know why. So we're gonna go in here and we're gonna tell you his story. And I promise you, if you hang with us, listen to this, you will learn something. You will respect this man. And if you're like me, you're gonna try to be just like him. All right. So back us clear up. You grow up ranching in Kansas?
Not so much ranching. I mean, we just had a small place, but grew up with horses, always had horses. We had a few cattle and stuff, but mostly, it was just all centered around the horses. And
Nice.
all I really knew in life was I was going to do something with horses at some point in time.
So what brought that? You obviously have a love for horses. So what brought that?
Yeah, I don't honestly know exactly what brought it. I just think being around horses, I mean, they're just amazing animals.
They
And
are.
to see something that is as strong and powerful and agile, but yet kind and like, I mean, usually wanting to help you and is just something that always drew me to horses. And so I've always wanted to be involved in the horse industry, and if there is any way to do it to try to help horses out as well, that's what I wanted to do.
That's awesome. So, when did you decide I want to be a vet?
Yeah, I mean it's a good question. It's interesting in the fact that I was exposed actually probably to vet school in a weird way. And when I say that, it's because my dad, I was in junior high school at the time, or just going into junior high school. He had been involved in family business and he decided, you know what? He didn't want to do that anymore and he was going to go to vet school. So kind of the family then ended up moving from the Lawrence, Kansas area to Manhattan so that my dad could do some pre-veterinary studies and then got into vet school. And so he basically graduated from vet school at the end of my junior year of high school.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So I knew a lot about the vet school, probably, which is interesting, as much as I knew about, you know, truly being a veterinarian.
Yeah, that is, that's super interesting, because a lot of people, I feel like, go down the road of being a vet and they're not realistic on what it takes. So you saw probably more of that than actually being a vet, and you still chose to do it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, people wondered what was wrong with me, probably, but, you know, I mean, cause my, you know, I mean, my dad going back to school, he graduated when he's 40.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he's struggled some,
I bet.
To try to get learning back into curve. That, you know, that mentality and that learning aspect and so on and so forth. So it's not only, you know, did we necessarily, you know, have a life of leisure. I mean, it was a struggle too, you know, through it all. And I mean, I might go a week and, you know, not see my dad hardly at all, just because he was constantly studying and doing stuff and that type of a thing. So, you know, maybe that would scare most people off. I mean, it just fueled a fire in me.
Yeah. Well, now the rest of your story that we're going to tell them here in a little bit, starting to make more sense to me.
Okay.
So your dad, no offense, he might've been pushing the envelope on the oldest graduated veterinarian, huh?
Yeah. I think he was the second oldest in his class. Yeah. I think there was one guy that was older.
Wow. Well, that's pretty admirable, but it's also pretty funny that I heard that you might've been pushing the youngest one to ever graduate.
Yeah, I probably was. I mean, I was 23 when I graduated vet school.
Whoa, stop. Hold on, back up. So 23 years old.
Yeah.
That rolls off the tongue pretty easy. Let's just flash forward in all of our minds, people, to where we were at 23. Can you imagine putting in it's equivalent to like 8 years of school, right?
Yeah. I mean, most people are 4 years undergraduate and then 4 years of vet school. Yeah. Yeah. I kind of didn't do it that way.
Dang, that is impressive.
Yeah, so I just did it. I was able to get all the qualifications, pre-veterinary work done, all that stuff. I got that all done in a couple of years. So,
how did you do that? Just by stuffing it all, like a double week into a single week type of thing?
I mean, I would just, you know, I mean, they would sit there and say, what, full time is 16 credits or whatever, and you know, most kids took maybe around 17 or 18 credits. And, you know, I'd have to go get some special consideration and talk to people and so on and so forth. But I would just try and take 22, 23, 24 credits. And so just try to, if I could get a class to fit my schedule, then I would take the class.
Wow. I bet you didn't mess around at all. Didn't have time to.
Not a lot. Not a lot. I mean, occasional college rodeo, but I miss most of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was still fun. I mean, some of it, I'm going to tell you also, was economically driven. I was paying my way. So I was going to be like, I wanted, you know. And the thing is, when I went to school, the beauty of it was, you know, you paid on a credit basis until you were considered full time, 16, and any extra credits you took, they didn't charge for them. So it's like, you know,
really?
So that was another enticing thing for me to get it done fast.
Holy encouragement.
Yeah.
That is like the only thing I've heard that makes sense about government programs or anything in a long time.
Yeah. So, I mean, they just, you know, as long as I could keep my grades up, you know, basically my advisor and the dean, they would sign off on it and they'd let me go for it.
I can't imagine the look on just looking at this 18, 19 year old kid, and he's saying, I want to do 24 hours this semester.
Yeah.
Can you imagine just being like, oh, you don't?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, and still even had a little bit of time for some part-time work and stuff. So, you know, I mean, there wasn't a lot of necessarily free fun time, you know, and I'd say that was the only real, but that to some extent was a little bit of a drawback. I mean, in that, you know, when I was in vet school in my first couple of years and I was underage and, you know, my buddies would go to the bar and I couldn't go.
Right.
So
got an axe to grind here.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's all right. That's all right. It all works out in the end.
Oh yeah, for sure. I can definitely relate to that. And I find that super admirable what you did. That's awesome. Me personally, I went to school on rodeo scholarships and messed around to the point to where I went in for a final. And as a joke, the teacher introduced himself to me. And then I left a full ride because I was like, what are you doing? You're taking all these easy classes, not getting anywhere.
Right.
So I left all that to go to school to be an electrician. And then I went to class all the time. And it's because I was paying for it.
Right.
So when I really have a hard time wrapping my head around paying for college just from hearing like your story and my story, because it seems like you got to have a little skin in the game.
I think it adds to it, right? You know, I mean, you know, you have to be self-driven, you know, but, right. You know, sometimes lack of funds can help that self-drive.
Yeah, it really is a blessing, you know, yeah. Like I really think that like we want to sugarcoat and make all these things perfect for our kids and people we love. And sometimes you hinder them by doing that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think, you know, and you can look back at it and you can say, okay, was it a hardship? Well, okay. Yeah. I guess maybe in some ways it was a hardship. Right. But I wouldn't trade that hardship for anything that I, you know, gained from it.
It defined you.
Yeah. So I think that it's a situation where, you know, and there's a lot of kids that, you know, don't have those financial hardships, and that's, and all the power to them, and are still just self-driven and great kids these days and that type of a thing. And, you know, I think that's just it, is that all these experiences just, you know, they mold the person. Oh, and sure. So, you know, and now me being a dad of two daughters, I mean, you know, yeah, I kind of darn sure want to help them out when I can, but I don't ever want to get rid of that self-drive.
Yeah. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah.
Okay. So you graduated college. You're the youngest vet to graduate, 23 yeah. years old. Gosh, I can't imagine. 23 years old. What happened next?
Well,
you're in Kansas, graduating Kansas State.
Graduating. This is late 80s, right? So, you know, most people at that point in time, I mean, you graduated vet school and then you went out and got a job. Well, you know, I was looking back at it and, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm I guess junior coming senior in vet school. And I'm like, you know, I didn't feel like I just knew enough, or I didn't know enough for me yeah. to be happy and make me comfortable. Like I wouldn't have wanted to hire me to work on my horse.
Right.
So
yeah.
I wanted to gain more knowledge. And so back in those days, there were a few universities that offered internships. There weren't many private practices at that time really that had any internship programs. And so I then said, well, you know, I want more knowledge, so I'm going to apply for an internship. And there's a program, an internship matching program, and I applied and through that. And lo and behold, matched at the University of Georgia.
Huh.
Yeah.
Georgia. Okay, yeah. Pause. Do you still love horses as much now as you did when you started vet school?
I think more.
Okay. All right. Back to Georgia.
Yeah.
Now what?
Well, so went down there and did a rotating internship. It was actually a large animal internship, so I did cattle as well and stuff.
Just
and,
to remind yourself why you love horses.
Well, maybe, you know, it's, you know. And so, so did the rotating internship, and it's medicine and surgery and, you know, farm calls and reproduction and all the different things that you do. And so did them all, and in reality, you know, had a great time. It was a wonderful place to do an internship. Hmm. Great people.
Really?
Great people. Being a kid from, you know, I still consider Kansas the West. Being a kid from the West, I felt a little bit like a fish out of water down there. Yeah. In Georgia, yeah. And it was, but I mean, great people and a great spot to be. And I mean, pushed you. And so at that point, I mean, I was still along the lines of, yeah, I mean, I gained a ton of knowledge there, but I still wanted to learn more. So then, you know, basically they, you know, I know I was more driven towards a surgical aspect than I was a medicine aspect or the reproduction aspect. So I went and then started applying for surgical residencies. So that's another, you know, 3 years of training after that.
Right.
And so applied for that, and still being a kid from the West and feeling like a fish out of water, I only applied to the universities that had open positions. I think there was four of them or five of them. They were all west of the Mississippi.
Right.
And then, you know, the day before, you know, for lack of a better term, we could remove our name from the match. George asked if I would stay and do a surgical residency there. So I stayed and did another 3 years at the University of Georgia.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Guess that's when you know you're doing the right stuff.
Well, I guess, yeah, they weren't trying to push me out the door, so that felt good.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you escaped without an accent.
Yeah. That was that. I mean, it's interesting, you know, the accents can vary there and they can be very strong. And I always tell people, I mean, you know, one of my fondest memories too, was I'd be an intern, we did farm calls, and I'd go out on a farm call, and, you know, I'd go out and I'd talk to the owners of these animals, and I'd actually have to get a student, and it had nothing to do with race or had nothing to do with, you know, income level or anything else, but I'd actually have to, like, sheepishly, you know, apologize and get a student to interpret for me because I could not understand their accent.
So you're arguably one of the nicest people that I know. So I feel like I'm there right now, where a lot of our friends wouldn't have troubles subbing in, being like, ma'am, I can't hear you.
Yeah.
Like, walk me through that. Like, what do you say? Like, I'm the lady go.
Yeah. I just felt horrible. I mean, I'd be sitting there and I, you know, I'd be asking them, you know, what the problem is. And, and I could understand maybe about every third word they were saying. And, you know, and shoot, I mean, you know, as we know, getting the history on things is really important. And,
right.
And getting, you know, owner's input is really important, still is to anything I do. And so I was sitting there and I would try. And I would try and re-ask it in such a way that I'd be like, you know, not trying to, you know, act condescending or being putting them down. And then I just say, you know, this is really important things. And, you know, it's my fault, not yours. But I'm having a hard time getting all this understood. So if you don't mind, I'm going to bring a student into this conversation and we're going to.
How'd that go?
It was good. Good. I mean, you know, as a general rule, you know, as long as people know you're trying to help them, they're really helpful. They're kind, you know, so, and that's what we're there for, is to help people, you know, help animals, but to help people.
Man, that's pretty special that you've had that gift the whole time to have that vision to take care of horses and people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, it's the love of the animals for what we want to do, what I wanted to do, why I did. And so, you know, it's the animal that drives you there, but it's still the people that you're relating to. And it's the people you're talking to, and it's the people that pay the bills. Yeah. So, I mean, you have to be able to communicate and talk to the people. And, you know, the one thing that I was never afraid of through my entire career was I really liked an educated client. I did everything in my power to try to educate a client because I wanted them to know why I was doing or recommending what I was doing and, you know, hopefully help them understand the value of what we were trying to give them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think people pick up on that too. Yeah. All right. So let's keep going. So you get your surgical deal at Georgia.
Yep.
Then.
Yeah. I got through my 3 years. Yeah. They wanted to know if I wanted to stay on for another year. And about that point in time, you know, and it's, you know, it's kind of funny because it's, I think it was my right close to when I was ending up my residency. And Dances with Wolves came out. And it's like, I went and watched Dances with Wolves and I am homesick. I gotta get west. And so I was like, no, I'm heading back west somewhere. I'm looking for a job somewhere. So originally went to Idaho.
So this has to be around the 98, 99?
This would be 91. Yeah. 91. Moved to Idaho.
Huh.
Yeah.
So, Idaho. Okay.
Yeah.
Kansas, Georgia, Idaho. Pay attention, folks. Yeah. This is important.
It gets a little more crazy after this. Yeah. Yeah. So it was an eye opener because I went to a practice in Idaho and I went to a few and interviewed at a couple of practices, but you know, I, for lack of a better term, I loved what they said. I loved what they were trying to do, so on and so forth. But I really was completely naive in the whole business aspect of it all that I did not know the right questions to ask. And so I was there for about 6 months and realized that this was not going to be any kind of a long-term, you know, situation, you know, for me.
Meaning there was not enough perks for you, such as business part of the business or low percentage.
Yeah. And even more than that, there was even a aspect of, you know, I was joining a smaller practice and it was a situation where there was one main guy that was doing the horse stuff. And he had been the one guy for a long time doing the horse stuff. So when I came in and started doing the horse stuff as well, and then all of a sudden, you know, I didn't realize, you know, to ask exactly, you know, what some people think of a busy schedule and what I think of a busy schedule is not always the same. So, had to hustle to try and, you know, generate some work and do that and did that. And then, you know, it just didn't meld right because, I don't want to say anything about anybody in per se, but then there was some jealousy about, okay, now all of a sudden some clients wanted to see me,
right,
versus the previous one. And it just wasn't going to be a long-term healthy situation.
Right.
So it's like, you know, so at that point in time, and then the other thing is that, you know, I did the surgical residency and stuff. And then, so a goal of mine was to then do the examination process of becoming a board certified surgeon, which is a fairly strenuous process. I mean, and you know, you usually spend, you know, about 3 months studying, and that's a difficult thing to do in practice when you're trying to build a practice as well.
Right.
So, you know, make a long story short, we left on really great terms and that type of a thing. And then I went back into academia and said, you know what, I'm going to go at least do some clinical teaching for a little while. And then that gave me the opportunity to study and then sit my board examination. So from there, Canada.
Oh, Canada.
Oh, Canada. Yeah. So went from there to Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada.
Nice.
So spent a year there. It was a sabbatical replacement. So I was basically, there was one of the surgeons that went on a sabbatical for a year. So I went up for a 1 year position to replace that surgeon, at the university. And it was a neat experience. You know, it was eye opening.
Yeah.
You know, I'd visited Canada once before, but you know, it's different, you know.
It's hard to explain.
Yeah. It's different living there, but great people yeah. Again. And, had a good year there. Some of the things, again, as you learn through these processes, some of the things that I had asked for through the process, you know, got reneged upon. I hadn't gotten them in the contract per se and stuff. So in essence, the time off to study for boards all of a sudden went away. Oh, yeah. And in essence, what I did was freed up more time for the other surgeons to have some time off clinics to do other things. And so, but I spent a great year there for a year doing clinics.
Was that the move where you run the new guy in the ground because we don't care about him?
Yeah. So I was just,
yes. Yes. Yeah. He so, said, yes.
Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, I mean, that being said, it's academia. It's hard to get run into the ground in academia.
Right.
the work ethic was a little different than what I was used to. So,
right.
Yeah.
Huh.
And then, so then I still had to get to my board certification aspect. So then I went from there to Washington State University.
Right. But hold on. So in Canada, you were doing a lot of teaching there too, though, right?
Yeah, a lot of teaching.
So what exactly were you teaching?
You know, I was just on clinics. So as part of their senior year, they rotate through different rotations. And so we'd have all the students down in the equine aspect. And again, it was large animals. So we did cattle as well, to some extent. You know, I did get to do a C-section on a musk ox, which was interesting. You
what
know?
Is a musk?
Well, that's an interesting call, because I'd seen pictures of musk ox, you know, and every picture I'd seen, all I saw them in was a stark white flat background. So they called me up one night on call and said, you know, hey, you know, and fortunately this was actually a research herd of muskox that they had there, because in the northern part of Canada, the muskox still plays a significant role for some of the native population there. And so doing research, and they called me up and they said, yeah, we need to do a C-section on a muskox. And I'm like, yeah, how are we going to do that? And they're like, well, it's halter broke. I said, well, that's a good plus. But then I, you know, so I'm going in to do this, and I'm like, I have no idea how big a muskox is. You know, how tall is this thing going to be? How big is this thing going to be? How vicious is this thing going to be? Right.
Right.
Make a long story short, it's a really kind thing. It's about the size, you know, is maybe about the height of a large Shetland, or, you know, a small pony.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So just did a C-section in a standing muskox. And, you know, the only difference was I had to be on my knees to do it versus being able to stand up and do it. Yeah.
I feel like that was a big letdown. So you ultimately had to work on a mini Hereford.
Like, yeah, basically. Yeah. But there's not much that is cuter than a newborn muskox. That little baby muskox is as cute as could be.
I'm going to be Googling that.
Yeah.
So anything else happened good in Canada? Did you work on polar bears?
What were no polar bears. No polar bears. you know, I did. Well, and this happened in Georgia too. I mean, I guess because I grew up a bit of a cowboy, that there were some situations where I'd end up having to either, you know, go rope some cattle, or up in Canada, it was actually rope some deer.
Really?
Yeah. You know, so I'd have to, I mean, shoot, in Georgia, I used to have to rope cattle out of the back of pickups and stuff. And then the nice thing is there's a whole lot of trees around there. So I'd rope one and then jump off and just kind of get it dallied around a tree somewhere. And, but it was, yeah. So no, the biggest thing you realize in Canada is we have a tendency to survive winter down here, and they live winter. They love winter.
Yeah.
So, you know, like if we went out and we'd go sledding or tobogganing or something like that, and it was 40 or 50 below, you know, that type of thing, you know, like if you took any refreshments with you, including alcoholic beverages, you needed to put them in the cooler so they wouldn't freeze. Yeah. You know, but, you know, other than that kind of stuff, it was, you know, but yeah, it was just, you know, really, really great people. Short days.
That's awesome.
Short days. Yeah.
You just let that 40, 50 below just roll off your tongue. Like, I think that deserves a moment. 40 or 50 below.
Yeah.
Actual temperature.
Actual temperature, yeah.
So anybody in Texas or South, there is a huge difference between wind chill and real temperature.
Oh,
because, I remember being in Fargo, North Dakota at a rodeo. And it was 30 below actual temperature. And I thought, oh, this ain't bad. And I just had to go a little ways, and I thought I was going to die.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, I'm of the age that I remember nylon tires on vehicles, right?
Right.
And when it was the cold winter days in Kansas, you know, they'd get the flat spot on the bottom and you'd have to drive them for a while, right? To kind of get the bump out of them, right?
Oh my God.
Well, that happened with my radial tires up in Canada.
Right? Wow.
They'd all get flat. Your shocks would freeze and you know, and it is one of the things I did negotiate going up there was I wanted a plug-in parking spot. Because you plug in your vehicles up there in the wintertime. And I would feel bad for the students because they didn't have them. So they'd have to go out every 2 hours and start their cars just to try to make sure that they would start at the end of the day.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so it's just, but, you know, that's part of life for them, right? They just, you know, I mean, they just, things are a little lower key, a little slower pace.
Mm-hmm.
Don't get worked up about a lot, you know? Yeah. And it just, that's one of the things I learned was to maybe slow my pace down a little bit.
Yeah.
Up there.
It's easy to make fun of people that are like that. But then at the end of the day, it's, we could probably use a little bit of that in our life.
Oh yeah. And then you can sit there and start feeling sorry for yourself. And you're like, but somebody settled this.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You know, now why they stopped there, I don't know, but right? Why they didn't keep going. But I mean, and then you think, you know what? I mean, we're a soft society.
Right. All right. So did you get any awards or anything when you were up there? Anything special?
I mean, they do give a clinical teaching award. And so, yeah, I got that year. I was lucky enough to get that. Yeah.
So, Brad is one of the nicest guys ever. So I have to pull out all of these highlights out of him. So that is a student reviewed award, correct?
Correct.
Well,
yeah. Students
think
vote on it. Yeah.
Well, I think anything peer reviewed is, and not graded. I mean, graded is important too, but I mean, peer reviewed, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it means a lot. You know, you just
they didn't hate you.
Yeah, you know, at least it seems like, you know, because I mean, they also thought I was hard on them at times, right?
Oh, really?
Because I, you know, my job was there to educate them and to try to, you know, not only impart knowledge, but I wanted to make certain they were getting that knowledge.
Absolutely.
And so I was one of those that would, like, you know, quiz them and test them and do things like that. So it's not nice only, to know they appreciated it.
Yeah. You're not only going to hear this, you're going to retain this.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
All right. So that, it's so fun to hear your story, because what I haven't told everybody that you don't know, Brad, is that he has built one of the greatest vet clinics in the world. He might not admit to that on here, but just Google Pioneer Equine in Oakdale, California, and you'll believe me, but top notch. But it's so fun to hear how this is shaped. So really, the Canada trip had to greatly influence your personal intern program at
it did. Yeah.
Pioneer, right?
Yeah, all the experiences along the way, right? So,
for sure.
You know, like the Georgia internship was a phenomenal internship, and I still think it's one of the best in the country. And so, you know, and again, they tested us and they pushed us, but they also, I mean, you know, they let us have a little leash, and, you know, but it was always overseen and always mentored and that type of thing. And I guess that's always what I structured mine about, was just saying, you know, I mean, I'm going to let kids do things, and, you know, I'm going to always be there for them if they needed something and mentor them along the way. But you know what? I mean, the only way you're going to learn and get good sometimes is to go try things. And absolutely. And so
get your hands dirty, make some mistakes.
Yeah. You know, or we tried to always get it to what, not quite to the point where they were making the mistake, but right. We would let them, you know,
right,
to try, and then, but you know, always overseen and stuff. So yeah, so it was, you know, like while I was there, I would put our internship program against anybody's.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. You get done with Canada.
Yep.
Where are we going now?
Washington State University, Pullman, Washington, the Great Palouse.
Huh. Yeah. Tell me about it. Like, just give me, for the people that don't know that haven't been there, just give me the aerial view, the look around. What's it look like? What's it feel like? What's it smell like?
Yeah, well, it's all, you know, old volcanic soil.
Wow.
And it is all, I mean, significantly rolling hills, some of them fairly steep, huge wheat ground.
Really?
Huge wheat ground.
Hmm.
And I mean, would, you know, where we thought in Kansas, you're doing great at 90 to 100 bushels an acre. I mean, they're getting 140 bushels an acre.
Wow.
I mean, it's an amazing farm ground area. It's right on the very eastern edge of Washington. We're 7 miles from the Idaho border.
Nice.
And just south of Spokane, you know, about an hour and a half. And it's actually, you know, a really great spot. But, and I ended up there because there was a buddy of mine who was a surgeon there, and they wanted to start a basically an emergency surgery program. And so he called me up and asked if I'd be interested in starting.
Nice.
That's what I did.
So did you come on as part owner then, or you just start
at Washington State? No, I mean, it's university, right? So you're just a university employee, just like any other university employee. Okay. Yeah. So I was basically, I mean, it was considered a clinical instructor in surgery. And so, you know, the difference would be is I would do some daytime surgeries and stuff like that, but my day started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon with rounds, and it would, you know, conclude with, you know, 8 a.m., you know, in essence, walk around rounds, you know, with, the kids that are coming on in the morning and stuff. So
at this point in your life, aren't you sick of being an employee?
Well, I'm not so much sick of being an employee. I'm sick of spinning my wheels and not getting paid much.
Right.
You know, but yeah, cause I mean, you know, still at that point in time, but I, you know, again, you know, I've always been one that, you know, you got a certain hurdle to conquer or a certain, you know, a certain thing that I need to get accomplished. And for me, it was studying for my boards, becoming board certified, you know, that type of aspect. And that was, you know, the driving force behind that whole thing. I knew academia was not a long-term solution for me. You know, it's a little too, it's a little too much red tape,
right,
a little too much inefficiency for what I like.
Right.
So, so in that situation, you know, I knew it wasn't long-term, but this was something that allowed me to still fulfill the goal I needed, which was get the time to study and,
nice,
and then, you know, take my test and, you know, and it's a 3-day exam and took my test and passed fortunately. And, you know, thankfully never have to do it again.
So this is just kind of eyes on the prize, embrace the suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got it. So were you out of there as soon as you could, or how long did you stay?
I was there for about a year and a half.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think I started in August, got my boards in, took my boards in February, probably got the results in March, and then ended up staying on because I was still trying to develop that program.
Right.
So I was trying to develop the on-call program with his kids and the whole nine yards and do all that standpoint, and then develop some kind of a foundation that they could continue on.
Right.
So until they identified the next individual to come on, then I left.
Right. So speaking of that, I have a question. So were you the youngest person to graduate vet school? Do you know?
I was youngest in my class.
Okay. So being that young, was it an issue? Was your age an issue, I guess, in your career?
No. I mean, the only time, I mean, there were times at Georgia, and I think just Georgia, but I'd actually have clients who were like, you know, you're a vet? Yeah, I'm a vet.
Is your dad
I don't believe you. I mean, like, literally, you know, for lack of a better term, almost carded me, right?
Right,
you know?
Yeah, right.
Like, I got to see your ID. I got to know that, you know,
right,
you're who you say you are, you know, type of a deal. But other than that, yeah, not too much. I mean, it was, you know, that, yeah, people thought I was a little too young for maybe some of it. I don't know, but I never let it bother me. I just went on with it. So,
yeah, I've always kind of had a baby face, so I've always been able to kind of relate to that.
There gets to a point where the baby face is good, and then it gets, you know.
Yeah, right. It's coming.
You know, so yeah. Yeah. So keep it as long as you can.
Well, that's the goal. Now it's important. but I remember Chris Cox saying that he would intentionally have a mustache or a moustache, as he says, just trying to look older.
Well, and it's funny. So, when I went to vet school, or applied for vet school, we had to go to an interview process.
Mm-hmm.
And so I actually did grow a mustache for my interview process.
Yeah, see?
which was kind of silly because, I mean, they all knew my dad, right? So that's a beauty. I graduated 7 years after my dad.
Oh, nice.
So they all knew my dad. So, I mean, they'd all seen me around there for a while. So.
Right.
So, I mean, I'm sure that helped me get in early, you know, but you know, cause I actually had sat there and thought, you know what, I'm going to apply and, you know, I'm going to be too young and they're not going to accept me. And you know what, I didn't need to take any more classes for vet school. So then I just take some business classes. And then I thought, you know, I might college rodeo for a year or, you know, go have some fun for a year. Well, then I got accepted and that kind of blew that out of the water. But, yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. Yeah.
Your future self says, thank God.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. No, no, no. It was going through a good thing. Yeah.
Okay. So where are we going now? We're leaving Washington State.
Leaving Washington State, knew I wanted to get back into private practice. And you know, there was this practice in Oakdale, California, Pioneer Equine, that, you know, was owned by some, you know, good people at the time. And I had visited that practice at some point in time in my career. And I had actually had kind of kept in touch and inquired if they'd have, you know, they had anything ever available, so on and so forth. They didn't have anything available. So I actually ended up going into private practice in New Mexico after. Yeah,
that's why you like Hatch Chilies.
That's it, man. That's where, that's where the green chili, you know, comes in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So went to Albuquerque, and, you know, and again, this was a tough one for me because I was only there for about 5 months working there. I was the only board certified surgeon in the state of New Mexico, large animal, small animal, anything.
Oh, wow. So you got every tough case, is that assumed?
Well, yeah. I mean, you still got to break, you know, a lot of people at that point in time still didn't know, I don't think, the value of the extra training or what all it meant, you know, right. But that's okay. You just keep working and things happen. And then 5 months in, you know, my old partner, Jerry Black in Oakdale, called me up and said, you know what, you know, the surgeon that's there was going to leave and he needed me. And it was the hardest thing I ever did was go talk to the gentleman that, you know, had hired me in New Mexico and tell him that, you know, and he was completely understanding. He says, yeah, it's a job, you know, it's an opportunity of a lifetime. You know, and you know, I mean, it's a little different these days and age. Cowboy capital of the world now, Stephenville, right? But as when I grew up, cowboy capital was Oakdale, California.
Absolutely.
I mean, I feel like I knew of Oakdale, California before I knew of Sacramento, California.
For sure.
So you know, it was a place that, and it's, you know, for those that don't appreciate it or know it, it is a rural area. It's a lot of ranching country right there. But it was, you know, it was neat because I ended up going to Oakdale and people would ask me, why'd you go to California? Why'd you go to Oakdale from Kansas, right? Right. And I tell them, well, I moved there for the rural atmosphere. And they'd be like, huh?
Right.
And I'm like, well, you know, I'd gone to more rural states like Idaho and New Mexico, but I had to be in the urban areas. I had to be in the Boise area. I had to be in the Albuquerque area.
Mm-hmm.
And those were big cities for me.
Yeah.
Right. Well, now I could go to Oakdale, which was a town of 15,000 people at that time, and work on even better horses and more horses. And because we had a, you know, they'd always been a fairly progressive practice at that point in time. And so, I mean, you know, we'd see horses from Oregon and Nevada and Arizona and, you know, Southern California and everything, everywhere else. And so, you know, we got to look at some really quality horses.
All disciplines, I assume?
Yeah, all disciplines. I mean, at that point in time, it was primarily Western performance horse. A lot of cutters were in the area.
Right.
You know, so a lot of cutters, a lot of reining cow horse, a lot of team roping, you know, a lot of barrel racing.
Yeah.
But there was also, you know, we darn sure had a lot of clientele come over from the East Bay area. And so that was the hunter jumpers and dressage. And
awesome.
Yeah, I got to see it all.
Me personally, I actually love a mixed. Like, I couldn't imagine just being the cutter farrier or just being the barrel racer or just being the English, the dressage or jumper or whatever. A lot of people do that, but it means you got to have more shoes and more options, more inventory. And that's about it really to me, because they're just horses. Would you agree?
Like, yeah. I mean, a horse is a horse. They don't know what, you know.
Yeah. There's different applications.
There's different applications of the horse. There's different talent levels,
but they all have the same needs.
Yeah. They all have the same needs. You know, and you know, the thing is that, I mean, you know, people are like, well, what's the most expensive horse you worked on? I said, I have no idea. I mean,
right.
You know, I don't know, millions, but
right.
You know, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what kind of horse it was. That horse is special to somebody.
Absolutely. And
it can be for economic reasons.
Absolutely.
But more often than not, it's for emotional reasons. And so, you know, and then the other beauty is that, like, of all these stopping points I had along the way, and I learned something along the way, not just veterinary medicine, but whatever it be, what I want business-wise, so on and so forth. You know, when I moved to California, I mean, the buy-in and everything else was all set before I left New Mexico. I wasn't going to go again without having, being able to have some stake in the game. So the other beauty about having a diverse population of horses was any part of the horse industry could die.
Yeah.
And we were going to be fine.
Recession proof.
Yeah. And so, and that proved to be very beneficial over the years.
Yeah. I'm guessing in about 10 years, we're going to get caught up with that, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Hold on. Let's go. Let's stay where we are for a second.
Yeah.
So finally, the Idaho is now paying off with your dream location job, right?
Yeah.
Now you know enough.
Good location, good horses, good business.
But you knew how to set it up so to not be taken advantage of and for it to be beneficial.
You bet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid of those hard times, people.
No, I guess I always, you know, and it's funny, you know, because I'll hear people talk about moving. Well, I moved a lot.
Apparently. Right?
And you can look at it in different ways, right? A lot of people look at it as it's a hardship, it's a headache, it's this, it's that. And I said, you know what? This is an adventure and this is an opportunity, right? Yeah. So I am going to go see different areas. I am going to work with different people and I am going to learn something along the way. So the only catastrophe of it all would have been if I chose not to learn something along the way.
Absolutely.
Right. So
amen.
Every little bit of it brought something to the table.
I think that needs to be wrote on a wall somewhere or something. Say it again.
Well, I mean, just to me, harness the opportunity and make sure that you take full effort in learning all you can at that opportunity. That's the travesty if you don't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So I'm from Western South Dakota and I was a little country dumb as well. Like when I first went to California, I thought, oh no, it's going to be a wreck. Thinking downtown LA in my mind, right?
Everybody does. Yeah.
And then I get
beaches.
There.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I get there. And let's talk about, say, like the San Ynez Valley, for example. I'm not sure I've ever seen a more beautiful place in the world. And I've been to Maui and Hawaii and different islands, Mexico. And would you not agree?
Oh, yeah. No, gorgeous country, and then good grassland, and great weather.
Then you find out, what is it, 80% of California is in ag?
Yeah.
Or more, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, there's a reason why it's the fifth largest economy in the world. I mean, some of it's tech and this and that, but it is by far the largest ag producing state.
Yeah. And there's ranchers, normal, like I grew up with in a ranching community. There are so many of that same like-minded people.
You bet.
All over California.
Oh,
I was blown away.
Oh yeah. No. I mean, that's the thing is granted, obviously I live in Texas now, right? And I could say you could take Oakdale. And you could put it anywhere in Texas and it wouldn't be any different.
Oh, yeah. You remember what was it when why were they rioting a couple of years ago? They were rioting and.
Oh, the BLM.
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're rioting. Remember this, people. They're rioting. They're breaking things. They're robbing all the stores of what they were doing, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oakdale had. They had AR assault rifles everywhere and people are just set up.
They come and get it. Obviously, you know, San Francisco
is
like an epicenter of that as long as Portland and stuff. And so that creeps over in the East Bay area, which if people don't know, I mean, that's virtually just west of Oakland. So it's right there. And then there's a little bit of a gap of what we call the Central Valley. It's all ag, right? Oakdale is nestled on the eastern edge of the Central Valley up against the foothills. And so, you know, they were threatening to, you know, okay, now we're going to start hitting these outer communities, right? And they basically had threatened that they're going to come into Oakdale and they're going to exert their influence or whatever in Oakdale. And word got out, and in essence, all along the main streets of Oakdale. Yeah. I mean, the citizens were all lined, some carrying it. You know, AKs and rifles and, you know, handguns or whatever. And all nationalities of Oakdalians were out there.
Yeah.
Curbside. You know, it's a good, you know, tight knit community.
It wasn't some bodybuilding bald guy some that you'd think would be holding this automatic weapon. You're talking about little old ladies ready to kill you if you take them to the store.
You know, I mean, there were a few cowboy hats along the right route too.
Oh, but,
absolutely.
You know,
yeah. No, I mean, it was anywhere from grandmas to ranchers to, you know, I mean, even the high school kids out, you know, in the area.
That makes me just swell up with pride.
Yeah.
For America. There's
only one violent act happened, and that was between two of the intruders coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah, they violenced on themselves.
Well, yeah, that was probably the best chance they had.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's
it was a good spot to be. The only problem with Oakdale is it happens to be in the wrong state. Yeah.
It's sad. I feel bad for a lot of people there. But moments like that, I was pretty proud.
Yeah. Yeah.
I feel like that's a good testament, though, like to the saying when, you know, all the bad press gets all the mileage, you know, when it's out there. But I feel like this country needs a lot of work, but there's still some really great things about our country.
Oh, there are, and a lot of good people.
Absolutely.
And a lot of people where family comes first. Mm-hmm. And in essence, that's all we were saying in Oakdale was, you know, we're going to protect our family. Yeah. You know, and we're not going to let people come threaten our families.
Yeah.
And Oakdale was one, for lack of a better term, pretty much one big family. And so it's like, you know, nah, we're going to protect our town.
Absolutely. And I don't, I love Jesus, and I'm not afraid to send you to him if you threaten my family.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, not certain they'll go there, but yeah. You know.
But, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Not certain you'll actually be meeting again. But on the flip side,
that's on them.
That's on them, right? Yeah. So it's still a good spot, but you know, for my sake, I mean, it was a great place. I mean, I was in Oakdale from 95 to when we moved here to Weatherford in 2022. And you know, the thing that, you know, prompted the move for us was not to get out of Oakdale, I have two young daughters. I still also have a lot of family in Kansas, and it was to be able to, in essence, bring my daughters and raise them in an environment, a safe environment that is like what I was raised in.
Right.
And that's why we're here.
Well, absolutely. Well, let's not get jumping ahead in the story.
Okay.
We got some good, a lot of meat on the bone here. All right. So your wife is arguably one of the coolest people I know. She isn't in the picture yet, right?
Not that time. No.
Okay. All right. So you're getting set up at Pioneer.
Yeah.
Give us the lay of the business a little bit. Like, all I know of Pioneer is this monster, high-tech, state-of-the-art business. How big is it? What's going on?
How big is it now or when I got there?
No, we're...
Okay, when I got there, yeah. So when I got there, it was me, my partner Jerry Black, and an intern. That's who it was, right?
You have more secretaries than that now.
Yeah, I got more secretaries than that now. Yeah, so... you know, and we had a couple of technicians that worked for us, and we did a lot of lameness work, a lot of surgery. And, you know, and it was a situation where, you know, we just kind of, you know, the thing I'll say about Jerry is he kind of let me have the reins and let me run with it how I wanted to run with it.
Refreshing.
Even though we were 50-50 partners at that time, I ran everything by him, but you know, he's like, you know, yeah, I mean, as long as it makes sense, it makes sense. And we were on 2.5 acres. You know, the neat thing about Pioneer had actually been around since 1972.
Wow.
And it was started by a gentleman named John Britton.
Hmm.
And John was one of what people would call the original leg guys. You know, he was originally a really good lameness guy. And he had actually gone to school at Cornell, because when he was in college in California, there was no vet school in California. So he went to Cornell for vet school. And he graduated, and actually he was originally working up for the ranch was where Seabiscuit was. So that's, yeah. So he cool. was, he was a vet up there with Seabiscuit.
I figured he was into the racehorses if he was that early of a good leg guy.
His leg guy, yeah. But the thing is, he always loved cowboys. And so that's what drove him. And he moved to Oakdale sometime in the late 60s.
Well, thank God
and,
for that.
Yeah, and then he started, and so he had his own single ambulatory practice. And then Jerry Black joined him in 1972. And so, you know, back in those days, I mean, the practice wasn't Pioneer. It was John Britton, DVM, right? That was the practice. And so when Jerry joined up, you know, and really the place that John was working out of was his wife's old family place. And there was a three-stall barn and a tree. And virtually all the work he did was under this big old oak tree, you know? Right. So, you know, as he said, that was a surgical area under the oak tree. And so Jerry joined up and they're like, oh, well, I guess we can't really call it Britton practice or whatever. What do we call it now? And I was like, well, it's on Pioneer Avenue. Let's call it Pioneer Equine. So that's how Pioneer Equine became cool. established. So not that we're trying to be pioneers in anything other than we just happened to be in that location, I guess, at that time. But
is that still the same location?
That was the same location until I built the new hospital. Yeah. Yeah.
Is the oak tree still there?
No, unfortunately there was, so it had expanded over the years. And so when I got there, I think we had about 25 stalls and, you know, a surgical suite, no longer under the tree. We had a surgical, actually it was an old converted dairy, you know, milking parlor that was converted into a surgical area. And so there, but we're only on 2.5 acres, you know, and we might, you know, it's a good thing we were probably just in Oakdale and on Pioneer, because we would have trailers parked alongside the road for a long ways.
Right.
You know, and, you know, you do as a business and a growing business, and you'd be trying to do surveys and stuff. And really, you know, we'd do surveys, and the only complaint we'd ever really usually get was our parking.
Right.
So we figured we were doing things probably pretty good, but we just flat out grew that facility over time.
Right. So what'd you do?
Yeah, well, so I ended up buying my partner out in, I think it was 2007, I believe. But even before that, you know, I decided that I was going to, you know, move the hospital and rebuild the hospital. And so I was able to locate about 20 acres, about 1.5 miles down the road.
Oh, nice.
And so, and it was rice ground.
Nice.
So they used to grow rice there. Yeah.
Perfect.
So good clay soil.
Nice.
And then took a number of years to get through all the zoning and the planning and this and that and so on and so forth. But then ended up building a new hospital that had, you know, 2 surgery rooms and a standing surgery room and 4 recovery stalls and 6 exam rooms and, you know, covered arena for looking at lamenesses and a farrier barn. And then we had 40 stalls. So
really, yeah. I thought you had more stalls than that.
No, well, we still had the old facility too. So we'd still use the 25 at the old facility.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you heard him, but he has an indoor arena for lameness exams. That was next level when I saw that, I'm not going to lie. So when you can, the biggest thing that I found with you as a vet is that you're not afraid to go through the weeds. You're not afraid to see that horse move in all situations and on different footings. Would you agree?
Yeah. I mean,
especially while blocking.
Yeah. Well, and my thing was, you know, a lot of our clients hauled a long ways to get to us. And so, you know, at least my goal was always to give them as absolutely as much value as possible at the time. And, you know, and the way to do that is to do everything in their power to try to truly figure out what the problem is.
Right.
And not say, well, okay, well, let's try this and then let's try that. And then, you know, so on and so forth. Well, let's figure out, you know, since, you know, it'd be beautiful if we could ask them and they'd answer, but They didn't. So right. I'd ask. They didn't answer.
The horse.
So yeah. So, you know, but the beauty about horses, too, is they don't lie.
That's true.
Right. So, you know, when they have pain, they have pain. And we did a lot of blocking, joint blocking, nerve blocking, whatever, to try to truly narrow down where the problem was. And then we just tried to make sure we had as good diagnostic capabilities to try to investigate the area, you know, whether it be radiographs or ultrasound or MRI or CT or what, you know. So we were always constantly trying to advance our diagnostics to try to see if we can figure out the problem, doing in our power to heal that horse.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's all about the horse.
Yeah. So I guess in some ways, you know, I mean, you know, some people say, well, we had a reputation for being expensive, but in reality, I think we saved people a lot of money, because instead of them throwing out hundreds here and hundreds there and that type of thing, we would try and put it all together, for lack of a better term, try and be like a Mayo Clinic approach,
one-stop shop,
and figure it all out. And I think, you know, by and large, I think we saved a lot of horses and saved a lot of money.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. We try to do the same thing in our practice, and that's why we have access to an X-ray machine, is because you have to have all the tools at your disposal if you want to be successful. And then you have to be willing to use them. Like, there's so many people, like, I've seen, whether it's a vet or a farrier, that just wants to bang this out and then on to the next one, on to the next one. And while it's going to be a low price, you end up wasting months or years,
right,
on a horse. And it's like a pet peeve of mine when someone says that this horse has never been lame. I'm like, to who?
Yeah.
Like, if you think your horse hasn't been lame, one, he isn't doing much, or two, you don't really know. Because what I've found is, like, horses, they're so pure. I absolutely love them. Like, you can, when you look into a horse's eye, I feel like you can see their soul. And when you can figure out if that horse that you, this person loves, is he at 80% right now?
Right.
Or is he at 40%? Because there's a lot of great, good horses that could have been great, in my opinion. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, the beauty is, a horse will generally always do their best and give their best,
yeah,
right? But sometimes they're hindered in being able to give their best, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you can figure out a problem to help a horse, like all the top horses, they do what they do, and they do it well because they love doing what they do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in my mind, I was always sitting there saying, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to make the client happy and this and that, but I'm also trying to make this horse do to the very best ability what it loves doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So you can tell we care a lot about horses, and that's what we're going to get into our series. But right now, we're going to pull it back over here. Let's talk about you and your story in Pioneer.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're building this monster business right now. Where's Karen?
Well, so Karen's,
that's Karen's his,
yeah,
wife.
Karen. Yeah, Karen's, so that's my wife. She's a veterinarian. She was working at a large equine hospital in Colorado, in Littleton, Colorado. Littleton Large Animal.
That's Littleton, got a great equine reputation there.
Wonderful
too.
Reputation.
Yeah.
Yeah, great people. Great people.
Lisa Lockhartville.
Yeah, and good friends. And so actually met her through, you know, my friends that were owners and stuff of that hospital at a national meeting in San Antonio, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, you know, awesome.
So that's how we met. And
so single people, continuing education is very important.
It's very important. Very important.
Those conferences, you got to go.
Yeah. And so, and so I don't know. I mean, we just hit it off right from the get-go. And so it was probably, it's still a number of years before, you know, she came out to Oakdale, you know. I mean, it's not like we just.
What year is this right now?
And
right now.
That I met Karen?
Yeah.
See, I should be able to tell you the exact date. She's going to be disappointed that I can't. But that would have been right around 2007.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
See, I pulled that out though without looking at it.
Yeah, you did.
So I did. Yeah. Yeah.
Just for, let so the record was, show he did two, that without being
yeah,
cued.
That was 2007. Yeah.
So that's pretty awesome that two vets were married. And just because, I mean, it takes a special partner to understand your hours.
And I think that's why there's are so many vets that are married to other vets, is because it's a, you know, equine veterinary medicine is not just a profession. It's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
If you're really going to do it to the best of your ability and do it well. It's a lifestyle. Yeah. And people have to understand that lifestyle. And and embrace the lifestyle, you know, because there's a certain passion.
Well, it's probably the only way you're going to take it to that level.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, let's not jump the gun, but just real quick, answer this one question. How many times do you think you got to see your kids during the daylight?
Yeah. So when I was working, when my kids were growing young and growing up out there, you know, I would try to see if I could race home and see them awake before they went to bed. And I might make it 2 days a week. Yeah.
Let's back up. Go over that one more time. So you would race home to get there before they went to bed, which is nothing crazy, like 8:39, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you would do it twice a week.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, and you'd still work Saturdays and some Sundays and stuff, right? So, you know, I mean, it wasn't uncommon to work 80 hours a week. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty admirable. All right. So you're just meeting Karen. Quickly talk about Karen. She's got a super cool story where she's from.
Yeah. So my wife from actually originally from South Africa. Yeah. So she moved here with her mom and her brother when she was, it was right before her 9th birthday. And so she moved from South Africa to Florida, and then they ended up moving to the Vegas area. And then she ended up going to vet school at Colorado State University.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and then she did the internship thing like I did. And she ended up actually staying at the practice. So she did her internship at Littleton, and then they asked her to stay on. So she stayed there.
Oh, wow.
You know, after that. And then she was there for, I think, like 8 years, I think, you know, after that. Yeah. And then I got to steal her away. So it's, right. Yeah. So, yeah, here's the beauty, right? So you not only gain a spouse,
right,
but I gained a business partner, and I gained a very good veterinarian business partner and a very productive veterinarian business partner. So it's a win-win for me and the business.
Check. Yeah. And you don't have to pay her when the times are bad.
Yeah. You know, well, yeah, no, I still did that. Yeah. So yeah, no, but it was good. And, you know, and I had been in a situation at one point in time through my moves along the way where it was a husband wife situation that, you know, wasn't a bad working environment, but wasn't a great working environment. Right. So I was always very, you know, I don't know, aware of that aspect. And so, you know, and I think you could ask anybody that ever worked for us that, you know, we had a really great working environment. And that's the thing is that, you know, the whole time I was there, I mean, Pioneer Equine, we were a no drama, you know, yeah, we had some stressful times and stuff, whether it be financial or, you know, more than anything, just stress saying, well, you know, we want a case to go well and it's not going as well as we'd like it to go or whatever. But we just always had a great working environment, you know, throughout the entire hospital. So that was key to me and that was important to me.
Well, it's a culture.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you lead by example, I guess, which means if you're going to treat people kind, generally other people treat people kind too.
Absolutely. And then you just hold up a standard and
don't
let people
change
it. So I find it interesting that you two are so alike. You both grew up super tough. If you never know anybody from where she grew up, I mean, I feel like everybody I've met is very similar, like almost like an Australian, you know, like just tougher.
Yeah. You know, I mean, no life of Riley, that's for certain, you know, for sure. And I mean, moved to, you know, and I mean, I give her mom all the credit in the world.
Oh, and she's wonderful.
Yeah. And her, you know, just so everybody knows, I mean, her mom It's funny. Her mom lives with us. She has as long as Karen's lived with me. And to be quite honest, and it's just a situation that, you know, I was always going to let those two be together because she had, you know, her mom had just lost her husband and that type of thing. So I was always going to let them be together. And it just it was a weird situation where she had an opportunity to rent the house where she was staying in. So actually her mom moved in with me before Karen moved in with me. So, you know, about a month before.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I think we might cut that out and run that at the beginning of the episode.
So you lived with
her mother. Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So the mother-in-law came to live with me before Karen did. Yeah. Yeah.
Such a special lady.
And she is. And she's been a blessing in our lives. And I mean, and it was because of her that allowed Karen and I still to not only be able to be focused on family, but be focused on the business and being a veterinarian and doing that because, you know, we had Oma in the house.
Yeah. We have a similar situation and with Jamie's parents. And, you know, it's one thing to have somebody watch your kids, but to have somebody that's willing to lay their life down with no questions asked for your kids, I mean, that's a pretty comfortable environment.
Well, and just to see the joy in their faces. I mean, their life is so much more fulfilled by being able to be with these kids.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's 2007. You're 50-50 partner. Mm-hmm. That's about to change, right?
Yeah. So I bought my partner out. He did not want to invest in a new hospital and stuff, which is fine. I understood where he was in his career. He didn't
You're
want
to
do
blow
that.
It up. He's
and not. I want to grow this beast. Yeah. And so ended up, you know, buying out his half of the practice and then we're building this hospital. And
hold on. Does everybody remember 2007? Do you think that'd be a great time to buy a business that big?
Yeah, well, 2007 wasn't so bad. 2008 kind of sucked. so I'm sitting there and I'm building this hospital and you know, and it's a significant financial investment for me. And as most people probably realize, but maybe they don't, but like, you know, any of this equipment we buy, anything of this, you know, we have to buy it, right? It's not, you know, an insurance company helping pay for this thing or any kind of a government subsidy paying for this thing. This is all personal paid. And so, I built this nice hospital and opened the doors January 2009, right when the economy crashed, especially in our area, pretty hard in 2000, right in the summer of 2008.
What'd they say? The house prices went down 60% overnight.
Yeah, they went 60% down in our area. Yeah. So
give us a ballpark dollar on the what you had just. I just want to hit the gravity of the situation here.
Yeah.
How much?
Our gross went down 35% almost overnight.
Oh my gosh.
And then stayed there. It took a little over 2 years for it to recover.
Oh man.
Yeah.
How long? So you're the sole owner at this point and you're married yet or not?
Not married at that time. No, okay. I just had just, to be quite honest, Karen and I were just doing a long distance relationship thing during that time.
Gotcha. So you were a sole owner of your dream. The economy just took a huge dump.
Yeah.
Your business, you just lost 35%.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me as a business owner translates all the profit, maybe a little bit more is now gone.
I mean, it's a little bit hard. I mean, a lot of people think veterinarians, you know, work off this huge profit. And well, actually, you know, a veterinary hospital normally operates at a 12 to 15% profit. Wow. It's not. Yeah. But obviously when you go down 35%, some of your expenses go down too.
Right.
But yeah. I mean, our profit pretty much went away.
Yeah. Exactly what I was getting at. So 12 to 15% profit margin, you just lost 35%.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're missing out on what is that? Like 18? It's more than that. Anyway, you're missing out
on opportunity. There's no doubt. Yeah.
So I mean, how long did it take you to, I mean, you weren't even making a paycheck. You were losing money then, right?
Yeah. Well, and it was one of those things that, you know, and our veterinarians were all paid on a production basis and that type of thing. So all our veterinarians took a bit of a hit because of they're being paid on production. But I didn't
at least cut, it didn't sink the business.
I didn't cut anybody's salary.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't cut anybody's hours.
Wow.
Except for mine.
Really?
Yeah.
So, so you just worked for free.
Yeah, I worked for free for a couple of years.
That's
again admirable. Long term goal, right?
Eyes on the prize.
Yeah.
Embrace the suck.
Yeah. Yeah.
Didn't take a salary for a couple of years. These things just roll off your tongue. And I just want to reinstate the gravity of the situation.
Yeah.
50 below is cold. No salary for 2 years is a lot.
I paid myself $100 a month is what I was paying myself. Now here's the beauty, right? So the house that I was living in was on the old property, right? So there's the house is part of the whole mortgage thing right there. So that was all encompassed in. So it's not like all of a sudden, you know, yeah, I still had mortgages to pay.
Right.
But it's not like, you know, that changed tremendously. The other thing was, it was also really easy to walk to and from work. So, right. You know, it was right across the parking lot.
Did you sell your truck too?
You know, I did not sell. It was an old truck.
Were you little?
It had no real value. Oh. At that point in time, I had one horse. That was it. And it was a retired horse. And, I take that back. He wasn't retired. I ended up, he's actually the horse that my 8-year-old daughter rides now. And he's 24. And
which horse is that?
The Cabo.
Oh, buckskin. Yeah. Yep.
And what I ended up doing was, which made my heart feel good. So I ended up, a friend of mine kept him. And I mean, I don't know how many kids, junior rodeo, junior high rodeoed and high school rodeoed off that horse.
Huh.
You know, while I was kind of getting through this time.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, and it's kind of neat. Like one of the technicians that ended up, you know, working for us, you know, down the line. I mean, she learned a breakaway robot.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that kind of a thing. So yeah, that all makes you feel good. You know,
that does. That's kind of like all I could think about when you said that is, have you read that poem, Don't Sell Your Saddle?
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing. Isn't it? It's like, don't give up just that little last foothold.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was my last foothold in the equine world. And so I had another horse and he was retired, but ended up, you know, to make a long story short, I mean, he ended up, you know, when he was, I don't know, late 20s, colicking. And so I ended up having to put him down. But on the flip side was he was the only one that I had at that point in time. And he was even a neat story because he was a Canadian horse. I didn't buy him when I was in Canada. But, you know, one of my technicians, she moved up to Canada to again, long distance relationship, met a guy, blah, 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 and moved up to Canada and then ended up working for a reigning cow horse trainer.
Oh, wow.
And she just really liked this horse, but he wasn't going to make the cut reigning cow horse wise. So I was like, okay, well, you know, and so I bought him on her recommendation. Didn't cost me a lot of money, you know. I can't remember if it was Curtis Cassidy or Lee or who, but one of the guys hauled him down, you know, I just paid a little bit of gas money for him, you know, and hauled him down for me. And then he just ended up being this special horse that, you know, and again, he's one of those horses that, he's like your gray horse. I mean, they are two kindred souls.
Right.
Those two are almost exactly alike. You know, those are the special kind of horses that, you know, well, you know, if anybody ever wonders why we love horses like we love them, all they got to do is know those two horses.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good comparison.
Yeah.
Okay. So moving along a little bit.
Yeah.
Things start getting better.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, things start slowly coming around. Yeah. Yeah.
Karen moves in.
Nice. Yeah.
Get married.
You know, Business continues to grow. She's a real asset to the business. We get up to the point where we've always had interns. So, you know, like actually Pioneers had an internship program since the early 80s. So it was one of the first practices ever to have one. But, you know, and like I said, when I got there, we had one intern, you know, and after that, we would generally have anywhere from 3 to 5 interns. And so, but we grew it up to where we were 13 vet practice.
Wow.
And yeah, and things were, you know, rolling along pretty doggone good, other than the fact of having to be a business in the state of California. Yeah, it was good.
Didn't you say at one time that you could have, so before I say this, this is a monster clinic out there, monster. But didn't you say if you'd have built that in Texas, you could have built it twice as big?
Oh, twice as big or 50 cents on the dollar. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, for instance, I could have built half that hospital in Texas for what it cost me just in permits, fire, and water, what I had to do from a water standpoint, let alone, you know, build anything up on the ground. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The permit stuff in California is truly mind blowing coming from someone from South Dakota to Texas.
Yeah, it took me 4 years to get it through the process.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It was a long drawn out deal. Yeah. You know, but yeah, we got there. We built it.
So no other partners at this point?
No, I mean, and that's the funny thing is that in reality, what, you know, and we saw it changing a little bit in the veterinary world long as we came along, but we were always willing to let anybody become a partner and buy in. But, you know, most of the kids that we were seeing come in to the practice and stuff just really had no interest in, you know, the ownership, which again, I mean, that's where I kind of get back to the whole self-drive thing, right?
Right.
And I mean, they had self-drive to, you know, they obviously wanted to be good veterinarians. They obviously wanted to gain the knowledge and stuff, but the business self-drive or the self-drive of doing something more, it just wasn't there. And so, yeah, so we ended up staying sole owners the whole time. But, you know, I mean, you know, I thought I had 3 or 4 that were going to buy in, and they're like, yeah, they just didn't necessarily want to be tied down to something, or didn't want the added responsibility, or, you know, whatever reason, you know, still stayed, still great veterinarians, still employed veterinarians.
Huh.
Yeah.
Part of me wants to feel bad for them. And then the other part of me says, you know, I mean, each their own, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that was their choice. And, you know, I would say that in 2008, 9, 10, I'd loved it.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, it ended up working out. You know, it ended up working out better for us in the long run.
You know?
So
good.
Yeah. So it was, you know, the good Lord does things for reasons.
Absolutely.
You know, and, you know, it's not mine to question, you know, and so we just carried on and you know, just tried to still keep it, you know, a great hospital with great working environment.
So you're known for being one of the best teachers in the business. How many people do you think you've helped through your career?
Oh, geez.
And this is not clinician either.
Yeah,
he's a great clinician, but hands-on, stop doing this, start doing this.
Yeah, I mean, just veterinary-wise or?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, shoot.
I mean, how else do you help people? Are you... Do you work on rockets?
I mean,
you work on rockets, don't you?
I think we help clients too, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, but, you know, I don't know, hundreds.
Yeah,
you know,
for sure.
Yeah, you know, through the time in academia. And then, you know, we not only had, you know, the interns that were with us for a year, but we had, you know, usually students and from all over the world come and spend time with us as well throughout the year, you know, so...
So I feel like one of the biggest things that I take away from your story is some things like work ethic, obviously, is a big one.
Yeah.
But I also feel like the business skills that you have are what allowed you to get where you are. So I feel like what you're talking about in your story maybe helped shape that. Is there anything else that helped shape the business side of you that you didn't talk about?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just... you know, I guess I had a goal in mind that I wanted, you know, I wanted to build, you know, I wanted to build the best hospital I could. And my goal would be, you know, and I don't think I ever achieved it. And, you know, and I guess maybe it's a frustration, I don't know, but I also wanted to be the place that if any young veterinarian out there, you know, somebody came and said, where would your ideal place to work be? They would say Pioneer Equine Hospital, right? So right. I wanted it to be the ideal work environment as well, right? And so, and I don't know that we ever achieved that, but that was our goal. And that was one of our aims along the way. And so to do that, I mean, you got to serve the horse, to serve that. I mean, you have to have personnel to do it. You have to have equipment to do it. You have to do that. Right. And the only way you're going to do that is to get good at business. And so it was a driving force for me to know as much about business as I could, to learn as much about business as I could. And then I was fortunate enough to be asked to be involved in the very first equine, what we call veterinary management group, which was a group of 20 hospitals from across the nation that would meet a couple times a year, you know, in essence, to strictly discuss business issues and solutions and things throughout that. And I joined that in 2000. Well, our first meeting was actually right after 9/11.
Wow.
Yeah. So I was able to, you know, early 2000s and do that. And then we were able to, you know, and then now I also had a great group of individuals that, you know, these were good businessmen as well that I could always count on.
Are you
for
talking,
any question?
Are you talking about the NEAP or?
No, it's actually called, I mean, it's literally called Veterinary Management Group.
Wow.
And so VMG is what they call it. And so there was one small animal one before us. We were the first equine one. And so there was, you know, like a couple practices in Florida, practice in Lexington, Kentucky, you know, I mean, you know, practice in the Northeast, you know, we had some in, we had one in Texas. There's a couple of us in California, you know, one up in Seattle area, you know, and so with the idea of making certain that we didn't do anything with that the Federal Trade Commission could get, you know, upset about, you know, because we would discuss pricing, we would discuss how much things were costing us the whole nine yards. So it had to be very diverse. And it actually was based off of, they did something like that in the car dealership industry.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
And so that's what it was a kind of the foundation of it and the based off of. And then they did it in small animal. And then a couple of years later, we did one in equine. And then I was a member of that for as long as I could be. And then, you know, once we sold, no longer a member of that. But yeah. I still consider, you know, those people some of my closest friends. One of them happened to be Littleton Equine. So
that's awesome.
That was the way to get to Karen too.
Nice. So one thing that I find super interesting is, so you're so involved with work and you're so involved with growing this massive business. And I don't know if we've said it, but they have their own on-site MRI there. That had to be amazing to have.
Oh, it was. I mean, it you know, advanced things so much. And we never looked at it. And that's the thing is, would I have loved it to be a profit center for us? It never would turn a profit for us, each and on its own.
Right.
But it helped garner a lot of knowledge and a lot of, now we have therapeutic options.
Well, you kick out all the guesswork on those tough cases.
So,
right?
Yeah, I mean, because there were things we discovered in the foot and elsewhere, but especially in the foot, that we'd have never known any other way.
Like a collateral ligament.
Yeah, collateral ligaments and bone bruises and, you know,
right?
And even, you know, bone bruising and edema and, you know, all of deep flexor tendon injuries way low and, you know, just all sorts of different stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
So with how busy you're getting growing this business and everything, I find it super interesting that you make time to be on the board of directors of the AAEP and the NEAP.
Yeah.
That is truly amazing. So that to me I'm a part of some nonprofits in the Ferrier community, and it's amazing the selflessness of those people that put their time into that. And it's just quite admirable. And I can't imagine how much time you gave them that you didn't have. But talk about the blessings that came from that.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I guess we are fortunate in a way with the equine world that, you know, it's a smaller community and we're a tight-knit community and that type of thing. But we have one major organization, the American Association of Equine Practitioners. And so, and, you know, and my partner, Jerry Black, he was very involved with AAP as well, which was a foothold for me to get involved in that. And so they, you know, so they kind enough asked me to be on some committees and stuff like that. And so I did it. But again, it was the idea that was my way of giving back to the horse world,
right,
and the equine world. And I'm just a firm believer that, you know, if your focus is always, I'm going to try and do what's best for the horse, or if I'm going to try and do what's best for the industry, then everything will be okay.
Oh, for sure.
Back to it. Okay. We were talking about the importance of giving back. So you've got this crazy busy schedule and you're making time to be on several different committees, board of directors for two associations. Tell me about that. What benefits, blessings have resulted from that?
Well, I mean, there's obvious benefits in the fact that you just meet other people of a similar mindset, right? They want to give back and stuff. So you just, you make your circle bigger, right? So there's always reward in getting to meet these other people and know these other people and that type of a thing. The other thing that's important to me is that we have one big national organization that has one big national meeting a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so one of the things that, you know, I've been on committee-wise, I don't know, maybe longer than anybody has, is what they call the Educational Programs Committee. It's since been renamed, but in essence, that's where we get to judge the papers that are being assigned, or being, I shouldn't say assigned, the papers that are being, you know, we put a call out for papers to say, do you want to present here? And these are the papers that come back, and we review those papers and get to, you know, kind of select through that process and say, well, yeah, this one meets the criteria to be presented at the meeting, and this one doesn't quite cut the mustard.
Wow.
And so it's the idea saying that, you know, okay, I get some say in saying that, you know, the quality of the continuing education that we're going to continue to present is still, you know, at a standard above virtually any other, you know, veterinary organization that I know of, other than your specialty organizations. So, excuse me. So, I mean, I just get personal satisfaction in that. You
right.
know, saying, you know, we're, you know, it's a goal to try and, again, I like educated people.
Right.
So,
right.
So I mean, I want, and I like quality and value. You know, if I can be involved with helping produce that, then I get personal reward out of that myself as well.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, some of it, especially like on the board of directors, saying that we get a chance to help lead this organization into the future and make sure it's still valid and good organization and all those things. That's really important. The people that you meet is important, but you know, it's just, let's strengthen the industry.
Heck yeah. So it's kind of like being on the school board. You can either complain about the problems or you can step up and fix them and lead them.
Yeah. Yeah. Try and at least have a voice.
Absolutely.
Right? And may make a difference, may not, but at least, you know, the only way you can't is not try. So somebody's going to listen.
Well, anybody that listens to this, they, I think they're all going to agree that you definitely have done your share of trying. Okay. So let's put a cherry on top of this. You've built this monster business. You've got your family going. You've got two daughters now. I guess we didn't talk about that. Yeah. Tell us about them.
Yeah, well, Shelby's the oldest. She's 11 now, and Tandy's 8. She's the youngest. And, I did the dad thing late in life. It was probably a really good choice. You know, I don't know if it's a choice, but, you know, at least it's the way it happened. for me, because I was so focused on building the business and that type of thing. And I don't know that I've been as good a father as I should have been. But on the flip side is now, you know, doing all I did professionally has now reaped rewards back to me that I do get to spend a lot of time with them and have a lot of fun with them.
Absolutely. Yeah, I bet in 07, 08, and 09, you'd have had to pick one.
Yeah, it'd have been tough. It'd have been really tough, you know, because, you know, I'm darn sure, you know, Karen, Shelby, and Tandy are my family, right? Yeah. With Oma and, you know, that's a family. But Pioneer was also a family. Yeah. So, you know, wanted to do everything to try and take care of that family as well.
Absolutely. Okay. Tell us what happens.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I'm sitting there and I'm 60 years old now. And, you know, the one thing about, you know, horses, they're wonderful animals to work on and stuff like that, but they can be a little hard on the body over the years.
Right.
And so with two young daughters and saying that I want to try and get them to the point where I can raise them like how I was raised. And then, you know, try and take it a little bit easier on my body. I had the opportunity to sell the practice. And so I ended up selling it. And I was fortunate enough to be able to, you know, have enough of a nest egg set aside, you know, that we were able to kind of uproot our family, move them here to Texas and enjoy life here.
So you are full blown retired at dead on 60.
Yeah. Yeah. For the most part. I mean, I still answer a lot of questions.
Yeah.
I do a few phone interviews. You know, I mean, Karen still practices some,
yeah,
you know, to some extent, and, you know, I enjoy helping her and she enjoys helping me but we're just having a lot of fun just, you know, building our place and kind of, you know, getting things all set up for family fun in the future and a future for our girls.
That's awesome. I really feel like God was a big part of your plan because you bought your place several years ago,
yeah,
before all the prices went up in Weatherford, Texas.
Yeah.
All over, but especially,
yeah,
here.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is that, I mean, we've been blessed in so many ways along the way. And that was one of the ways we were blessed, that when we sold the practice, we got paid for part of it a few years ago. And so we had some money that we could invest. And Karen and I looked at each other and it's like, well, you know, we know probably family-wise, California is not a long-term future for us. So where would we potentially want to go live at some point in time? Well, we have a lot of friends in the Weatherford area and it's a horse area, which we're so focused on horses that, you know, it's nice and comfortable for us to be in a horse community area. And so Weatherford was a natural fit for us. So we came down here and we were blessed to be able to get a situation where we not only were able to buy before the market boomed here, we were actually able to buy for under value back then,
right,
just on the situation that was happening. So yeah, I mean, we couldn't have timed all that any better than we did.
Absolutely. Maybe it wasn't you that were timing anything.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, just like, you know, I mean, we had the bad timing of opening the new hospital right at the, you know, for lack of a better term, worst time. But, you know, this all happened at the very best time. So
absolutely,
things always happen for a reason.
Absolutely. So I find it interesting, you know, like you fell on the sword. I mean, you put all this into your vet clinic and now you get to spend so much time with your family.
Yeah. Beautiful.
I feel like you are just like the ultimate dad. Like you just walk around, like just thinking about what you can do for the women in your life.
Well, I have a lot of them too. But no, I mean, I don't know that I'd put necessarily a lot of truly focused thought in it. Like, you know, and maybe I probably should more planning like I did on the business standpoint and stuff. But it's just experiencing life and having fun and
a little bit of that Canadian life.
Stuff. Yeah. And enjoying it and, you know, and enjoying the process and enjoying the work and enjoying, you know, I mean, Karen is my very best friend. So, you know, the fact that I could spend almost all day, every day with my best friend, that's a wonderful thing.
Absolutely. And you two are very fortunate.
Yeah.
I couldn't imagine, like, listening to your story, you know, like what you bring to the table as a vet or as a consult. I mean, I know you do a lot of, what is the word, legal expert witness?
Yeah, I've been some expert witness, done some expert witness stuff. Yeah.
Have you ever been beat?
No, not that I know of. At least they told me I haven't. I don't know that I ever looked up the.
This is the most humble man ever. You know, most surgeons, they, from what they tell me, not categorizing anybody here, profiling, but large egos as a whole in the surgeon world, and you definitely don't have one. So very, very fortunate.
Well, I think it's one of those things that, you know, I guess I never felt like what I did defined me.
Right.
Right. Or made me. Cause I had some good friends ask, you know, how could you sell Pioneer? That's your legacy. And I'm like, that's not my legacy. I mean, yeah, there's great people there and I loved it the whole time. My legacy is my kids at home. That's my legacy.
That's your team. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, but I think for a lot of people, doing what they do becomes their identity. And mm-hmm. It was never my identity. You know, and it's not that I didn't try to do it to the very best of my ability every day, but it's never been my identity.
Absolutely. That is something that I need to wrap my head around as well, too. That's pretty awesome. So now, tell us, give us just a little bit of insight on these series that we're going to do. So we're going to just try to help people with their horses with some just common issues, problems and stuff. So you're known for having one of the best eyes and feels in the industry. So getting back to watching horses move, watching lameness, give them just a little sneak peek, a little sliver here. If they get to look in your eyes, what do you see when you see that horse circling to the left for a couple and then to the right? Tell the foot hitting the ground. I mean, tell us what you see.
Yeah, and it's funny because I don't know how many times I've been asked that question because of all the students that we've had, you know, come to clinic and they're like, what do you look at? What do you look at? And I said, well, I said, as you're starting, it's hard. I mean, you know, you don't develop an eye overnight. And you don't develop a feel overnight. I said, but they, you know, when they asked me, what do you look at? I said, well, I just look at the entire horse because I can see the bigger picture of the entire horse. But, you know, from my standpoint, you know, when I was doing lameness exams and is, you know, I observed horses as long as they weren't too lame to do all the gates. I observed them at all the gates. And that included, there's a lot of observation at walking. And there may have been observation of walking more on a, like an asphalt or concrete surface and a, you know, a dirt surface as well. It, you know, that type of thing. But I always looked at my lamenesses on both a hard surface, a firm surface, and an arena or a soft ground surface, because it tells you a lot. I mean, you know, the horse, you know, if you sit there and you watch them and you watch them enough, the horse tells you a lot by the way that they're moving, the way that they're landing, you know, and that aspect. And then I would watch them at a walk, trot, and canter, usually, you know, canter just probably pretty much on soft ground, occasionally on hard ground if I needed to. You know, my personal preference was I liked watching them on a lunge line. I liked them on a looser rein. I didn't like anybody really having a hold of their head or anything, because I think the head excursion, excuse me, how that head moves tells me an awful lot about the lameness. And so I liked watching them, you know, circling left, circling right, trotting, walking straight lines, trotting straight lines.
Tell them how big of a lunge line. I know you like a long one.
Yeah. I mean, you know, ideally I would like to have a horse at least on 25 foot of lunge line.
And you believe that you need to be on the outside of the circle?
I like to be on the outside of a circle, you know, looking, because I, you know, maybe it's just me. I get dizzy or whatever. But if I'm on the inside, it's hard for me to see the whole picture.
Right.
But if I'm standing on the outside of a circle, then I can see the whole picture. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And then we might even watch them under saddle too. You know, so we had the ability to, you know, have them be ridden and have owners ride and that type of thing. And there were some really hard lamenesses to figure out that, you know, might have been really, really hard for me to see. Owners felt like they could feel something, or trainers felt like they could feel something. And I might do blocks and then have them get back on them. And, you know, as long as it's safe for the horse to move with a, you know, primarily just a joint block or something, but, and say, okay, does that feel different, or that, that aspect? Because the name of the game was to try to just make that horse better, whatever it took.
Absolutely. That's awesome. Always going back to helping horses, helping people. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it amazing though? I've found it in my career too, that the information that a true horseman can give you, to me, is just mind blowing.
Yeah. I would honestly tell you that my biggest regret in veterinary practice when I was in Oakdale was, because I was working as many hours as I was and working hard and going from one thing to the next and this, that, is I didn't spend the time I should have with a few key horse people out there and try to learn them. Yeah. And, you know, most specifically the one that, you know, comes dearest to my heart is probably Benny Catron, who was kind of a forefather of the hackamore and, right, and that type of a thing. And, you know, and I used to just, I'd go to his place. It'd be one of the places I would go when I would do work. And I would just look in his tack room and just see the lines of bits in there. And I never spent the time to truly talk to him about those bits and when he uses them and how he uses them. And I just didn't learn from him. I miss, you know, that's why I guess I try to take opportunities when I get them, because I darn sure regret them when I don't take them.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you could do it over again, what would you do different?
Oh boy, there ain't a whole lot I'd change with the way it turned out, you know, because it couldn't have turned out any better for me right now. So if it took everything that happened the way it happened, you know, I wouldn't, to get where I'm at today, I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change a thing. You know, veterinary medicine has been a huge blessing in my life, you know, and the horses darn sure been a huge blessing in my life, you know, and the ability to teach and, you know, go to meetings and give presentations and do things like that's been a blessing. And so, you know, the only thing that, you know, I hope to be able to do is just, you know, my only real worry at this point in time is, because I am retired and I have the time, I still want my girls to remember the effort that it took to do it, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah, you don't.
So
yeah.
I worry a little bit about, you know, I shouldn't say making life too easy for them, but, you know, I want them to value, you know, the, you know, everything we have didn't come necessarily easy. And
sounds, you know, like nothing came easy. In
yeah,
your story.
There's just a price you pay and it's worth it, you know, but you know, so that's my biggest fear today.
So how do you, I couldn't agree more. I always say that, like with Jamie and I rodeoing, that we're blowing our, what we were going to give our kids. But I always say that everybody that I've seen give their kids a lot of money usually didn't work out very well.
Yeah. Yeah. Or give them anything. You know, I mean, you know, one of the issues that we were seeing in, you know, in the veterinary industry and stuff like this is that, you know, there's a sense of entitlement that's coming through with these younger, you know, graduating veterinarians, but not just veterinarians, graduating kids. And it's not all of them, but, and that, you know, doesn't necessarily fit what, you know, we were trying to do it at our hospital and that aspect. And the biggest, you know, the biggest change that I'd seen in my interns, because we always, I mean, we were lucky. We would get the best of the crop. You know, we just had a good internship program and the good ones wanted to come.
That's lucky.
Yeah, that was lucky. We got the good kids. Yeah. And so they generally always came with good work ethics. But what I kind of found was, is that, you know, I would tell them as I started meeting with them and stuff, it's like, you know, the first thing I'm going to have to teach you guys how to do is to start thinking for yourselves. Because so much of their growing up, they've been told exactly what they're going to do and where they're going to be and when they're going to do it and that type of a thing. And they have never had that opportunity to really think for themselves, stretch themselves out there. Yeah, you might fall. You might skin a knee. You might screw up a little bit.
Right.
But that's part of growing up. But you can't get anywhere if you can't start thinking for yourself. And so, you know, and I would have them come to rounds and they'd always have all these notebooks and writing all these notes and this and that. And I'm like, I'm taking your notebook away. You know, you got to start thinking, you know, nice. Yeah. I mean, not just relying on the notebook. And so that was a, you know, and that's a society thing. That's not just a veterinary thing and that type of a thing. But and that's what I want to make certain my girls do is they know how to think for themselves. They know how to problem solve. They know how to you know, get a goal, aim for that goal, and do everything in their power to try and achieve a goal.
Well, I think you're well on your way, judging by how you got your girls going. The only thing that I'm blown away by is how you stay in such great shape with how good of cooks Oma and Karen
yeah, I'm
are.
Spoiled.
Yeah.
I'm spoiled. Yeah.
That's
yeah. I just tell them, you know, I need smaller portions as they age. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and I might still be hungry, but that's okay. It's just smaller portions. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I like it. Well, I hope that everybody learned as much about your story as I did. And I hope everybody can see through how humble Brad is and for what he's done to build a business and to sell it for a lot and to go out on top and to still have all this life left with his family. I couldn't imagine anything better worth achieving in life. Seeing so many people throw away their family for one more certification, credential thing behind their name and or whatever, or money in general.
Yeah.
And you seem to have checked all the boxes and pretty admirable, and I'm proud to know you and good job in life.
Well, thanks. I mean, we're just blessed. We're blessed to be here. We're blessed to have friends like you. And, you know, we count our blessings every single day. We are truly, you know, I mean, I look back at it and I'm like, gosh, I mean, there's no way I could have ever planned it to be exactly like it was. But if I could have, this would have been exactly like it would have been, you know? So it's just been a beautiful thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. Well, all right. So if you liked what we did here, so this was just the big story. I realize this is going to be a long one, but we're going to get into a bunch of different series. And so if you want to hear something specific, you got to put it into the comments, review, just write us a review. Tell us what you want to hear from me and Brad. We'll cover all the talks on shoeing to veterinary work, to performance horses, to anything you want to hear. And also, other speakers that you'd like to have on, please put them in the reviews as well. And please share this, like, and give us a high rating, 5 stars, please. That's what we need. So I hope you have a great day. I hope you learned as much as we did. And God bless America.
Yeah.
Have a great day.
Good job.